Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking, I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hi, listeners, and welcome to the New Books Network's special series, New Books and Celebration Studies. My name is Emily Allen, and I'm your host for this episode. For today's episode, I am talking with Dr. Fabian Holt about his book, Everyone Loves Live Music, A Theory of Performance Institutions, published by the University of Chicago Press in 2020. In Everyone Loves Live Music, Fabian Holt shows how festivals and other institutions of musical performance have evolved in recent decades. Adopting a critical approach, Holt upends commonly held ideas of live music and introduces a theory of performance institutions. The two central institutions of popular music, the club and the festival, are analyzed within the broader history of music and cultural life in modernity, shedding new lights on organized cultural life and capitalism, urban media cultures, and the role of festive events in society. Everyone Loves Live Music argues that while live music provides exciting experiences for many people, it also promotes a new ideology of music and neoliberal capitalism. Dr. Fabian Holt is Associate Professor in the Department of Communications and Arts at Roskilde University. He is also the author of the book Genre and Popular Music, also published by the University of Chicago Press. So, Dr. Holt, thank you so much for joining us on this episode of New Books and Celebration Studies.
Thank you.
Looking forward to our talk. So yeah. Before we get into the book itself, can you tell us a little bit more about yourself?
Yeah, I mean, I'm Scandinavian, as you can probably hear. I'm Danish, but I've also traveled different countries. I did a book on genre in 2007 that was mostly based on some time I spent in Chicago. I've also worked in Germany. I studied music. So my formal training is in musicology, especially historical musicology of popular music. And since then, my expertise has evolved expanded and transformed into sociology in particular. So my approach to music and to festival culture is more social scientific, but it combines sort of musicology, I think, with sociology.
Great. And I think that definitely shows over the course of your book quite well, kind of how interdisciplinary you view these, you know, institutions of popular music. So I'm excited to hear you talk about that more. Going on to the book itself, can you talk about your process of writing Everyone Loves Live Music?
Oh, that's a good question. It's something I'm happy to talk about because I left it out entirely in the book. You know, I was thinking if I should reveal something in the foreword. There's a lot of drama behind the book. First of all, the book has been in process over a period of almost 13 years. Although it wasn't until 2016 that I sort of started writing the book and said, okay, now this is going to be a monograph. I'm going to write a book. But I've been exploring the area of live music since it became sort of a big issue in the 2000s, in the late 2000s, when there was this story about how, you know, the live music industry was going to save the music business What happened was that, I mean, I think also others discovered that this was an exciting topic and we wanted to teach or study, you know, festivals and concerts, but there was not really any theory or it was not an established field of scholarship. And for this reason, I think in retrospect, all I was doing for some years was exploring different possible sort of approaches and theorizations, and my research was largely empirical actually, because I've been building sort of the theory of live music and the feel of live music sort of from the empirical research basically, and then later on drawing inspiration from various disciplines, but. So the book has been it's been in process for a really long time, and then in 2016 I made this decision to write the book that this was now going to be a monograph, and that was the beginning of the three most intensive years of my life in terms of work. I was working from 4 a.m. to extremely long hours every day for at least 2 years, and revising, you know, it was proposing different theorizations, finding out that it had to be done differently, at least in three rounds. I never done was to delete 50 pages in one round and many other. Many more pages in another round. So the book is actually a distilled. It's a condensed, product of a lot of work and larger drafts.
Yeah, sounds like it was a lot of back and forth.
Exploration. So if someone was going to ask me what the method was. I mean, I can say that the method is to ask a question and then examine it and use some theory. But the more complex truth is that I was asking many questions, testing many theories, back and forth before I landed on the question became the sort of the main research question and the theory that became the main theory.
Right. And kind of thinking about that, like all these different approaches you bring in, you know, into this book, who do you think maybe some target readers for this book might be?
The target readers are people interested in music studies and of course it's sort of the topic, but in music studies, music students, music scholars, but also sociology, especially cultural sociologists and festival scholars. So those are some of the, and urban studies. I've learned that there are people in urban studies that are also drawing inspiration from our work, and urban theory is an important part of some chapters of the book. So those are the main areas. But I think it's a book that's it wants to make a contribution to a small network of specialists in thinking about music and culture and modernity, and then offer a lot as much as possible to a much wider audience. So that's what the book is trying to do. It's not alone, you know, targeting to the general reader. It really wants to do something for the specialist in this complex area of research at the same time offering something to a broader readership.
Right. And, you know, looking at music studies, what do you think this book adds to the existing, you know, body of research in that area?
I hope that a very specific and simple contribution is to point to the role of you know, festivals and concerts in musical life. Music studies has this focus on aesthetics and the experience of music. And what this book wants to do is to show that the musical experience and musical culture in complex ways are shaped by the seasons of festivals and concert life, is everyday concert life, and understanding, you know, concert and festivals sort of can expand and explain many aspects of musical culture that might not be only about, you know, about the music itself, but certainly it can explain a lot more sort of about how music is understood and the value music has in society to many different groups of people.
Right. I think that comes across too with, like, you're talking about your urban studies components that you brought in and the sociological components. I think you definitely do that.
I'm sorry to interrupt, but I just wanted to add that I'm thinking specifically also of the discussion of festivals and musicology, where this is the situation now that festivals have been a big issue in cultural life for decades now, and festivals have been important for a long time, but there's been this festivalization of society and culture for decades. And still, I mean, there's no handbook of music festivals I think festivals are not recognized at the core, in core conversations about what musicology is and how it should be conducted.
Right. Absolutely. So this is definitely a big, I think, springboard for that to happen as time goes on. Also, going on to the content of the book, let's start with maybe the most obvious starting point, the title, right? Yeah. So why did you decide to name the book Everyone Loves Live Music?
Naming a book is sometimes difficult, and it was difficult because the book is somewhat broad and has a complex narrative. So it has many potential titles. I think Everyone Loves Live Music as an element of, it's referencing the live music literature, the scholarship on live music that has developed in the past decade or so. So it's a contribution and a comment on that literature. But it's also a comment on the public perception of live music as this curious situation where everyone seems to like live music, but for different reasons. And when scholars inquire what live music really is, you get different and confusing answers. And I think that one of the reasons, I think the main sort of, you know, point is that live music has been promoted. The positive images of live music has been promoted by the industry. It's loved by consumers, and by politicians that want to stimulate sort of creative economies, cultural economies in cities. But there's a lack of critical, you know, thinking about what this is doing to musical culture, that in some ways, you know, live, sort of the popular image of live music is narrowing the way we understand musical culture, because it's reserved for some kinds of music, for some kinds of performance, for some kinds of music events. And this is something this sort of critique is important early in the book, where I basically say that what we are seeing now in the past decade or two is a commercial exploitation of the folk narrative, of the folk idea, or the sort of this vernacular idea of sort of live music that emerged in the mid 20th century, when the live music was simply the alternative to recorded music. What has happened in the past decades is that live music has become institutionalized as a commodity. Now, live music is not it doesn't only refer to the situation of listening to something sort of, you know, that's happening directly, sort of simultaneously, but either you are there in person or you listen to it online, sort of. But it refers to the arrangement, to the social arrangement whereby, you know, consumers are buying tickets and going to an event, to a commercial event.
Right. And, you know, you do a good job of kind of articulating those main thoughts in your introduction. And then, of course, kind of the tangible aspect is you choose to focus on, you know, the club and the festival as kind of your focal points. So yes, why did you choose to look at those two domains, the club and the festival?
I think to start with festivals, I think there's little... it's not hard to decide that festivals are important. It's really the dominant form of musical performance today, the dominant type of music events. Festivals have just, festivals are everywhere, and they're imitated in communication and politics, in many different areas of cultural life and social cultural life. Clubs have been important for a century, and they illustrate both examples. Both the club and the festival illustrate this transformation or this evolution from what I would call an institution of, something that's organized by smaller communities to becoming owned by corporations. So, and that's why, for instance, the arena or the stadium, are not sort of central to the book, because they have not undergone the same transformation. But the club, it used to be, and there's still this image of clubs. Some clubs still have that function, but fewer. Clubs used to be this place where neighborhood communities of musicians and fans would sort of get together and meet regularly, and some kind of social capital would develop, a sense of community around music, and the same with festivals. And festivals really started, sort of pop music festivals started with these bohemian scenes in the city, sort of migrating to a rural site in the summer season. I mean, San Francisco, some of the first festivals there in San Francisco and other places in California, but also Woodstock, and really the first Newport festivals, the first, you know, you would say jazz and popular music festivals were the Newport festivals. They also evolved from clubs, and they essentially sort of presented the stars of the New York jazz scene, yeah, and later the folk scene.
Right. Yeah, I think you do. I think you organized those two, as you call them, domains really well in the structure of the book, and you know, do a good job of kind of establishing the importance of those spaces too. Throughout, and then again, just doing all this to kind of give our listeners a foundation for the rest of the discussion. There's also a key term here that you use throughout the book, performance institution, which you explain in the introduction is, quote, a model of production and consumption in a particular type of performance space that has become socially meaningful and symbolically important in cultural life through frequent repetition and experience of the culture's rituals and values, end quote. So can you talk a little bit more about a performance institution and how you theorize that term throughout the book?
The one way to explain this is that I think a real challenge in both studies of clubs and festivals has been that scholars have authors have been writing about individual clubs and in some cases observing trends across clubs and across festivals, but that there haven't been there's been this lack or it's possible to build further or to sort of to develop the analysis further by having some explanations of the structural dimensions of this. So for me, the word or the term institution emerged when I was thinking about not one festival but the general concept of festival. So, for instance, looking at changing ideas of what a festival is or what a festival can be. So this is really the core for me. The core sort of idea of the institutional approach. This is to think about not only one example, but to think about what this is an example of. So within the urban sort of landscapes of clubs, there's been a transformation from the club as a neighborhood space, or as a space of a neighborhood scene, to the club becoming more like a small concert hall. This becomes the dominant model of the club, and to think about how the perception of clubs changes, how the image of clubs changes. The institutional approach sort of allows us to say that this is a general image of a club in general, not just one club. The same with festivals. And then sort of institutional theory, it's really fascinating area of social science research that originates in thinking of Durkheim, Emil Durkheim, Karl Marx, later sort of Weber, Max Weber has written about it. And then in the 70s, it became a distinct field of social theory, and specifically in the area that I engage with is organizational sociology, in which the interest is to understand why organizations in a field become more similar. Something that could be observed across different organizational fields, and clubs, can be understood as an organizational field. There's a field of clubs. There's also a field of festivals, and it's actually, in some ways, what has happened in the past two decades with the live music industry boom, the evolution of the live music industry, how it expanded from arenas into festivals. Really the story of the concert industry is that many clubs became sort of the clubs that survived and the clubs that have grown have become more similar. Sort of both the design of clubs, sort of the spaces, the programming, the opening hours, and the same with festivals. I mean, festivals have also become more similar internationally. So a festival in Roskilde where I work is much more similar now to Coachella or to Lollapalooza than it was, two decades ago or three decades ago. And an institutional theory within organizational sociology explains sort of this role of the industry, these dynamics in the industry in terms of, you know, centralized ownership and other things that also monopoly, sort of dominance and dependence on the same pool of stars, among other things, explain, you know, why festivals in many countries are becoming more similar. And I think that perspective, I think this perspective is something I've been missing when I was reading scholarship on clubs and festivals, and something that I think that is relevant also to musicology and to music studies, because this is really affecting what music is and what kinds of music people hear, the images that are promoted in public life of music. Because, you know, I mean, Coachella is pretty influential in popular music and as is other festivals. So I think that this evolution, this development of the in the organizational fields, especially in the content industry, is highly relevant to music scholarship.
Yeah, definitely. I think, especially in your opening chapters, you establish that really well with, you know, the importance of these performance cultures and institutions, you know, in different disciplines. And I think that sets up the, you know, more specific case studies throughout the book really well. Maybe
thank you.
Going on. Yeah, I know it's not easy to set up that much content.
I at one point it was so tough to write this book to finish it that I didn't have any expectations if people would like it. So every time someone says a nice comment about the book, I'm very pleased.
Oh yeah, you're at the end of your journey, and I know it's good to see the product coming together with all that work. So I think maybe the next place to go is, again, kind of the binary of this book is club festival, you know, discussion. So let's maybe just get into the club context here.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So, you know, you have that section with that set of chapters about the club, and the first chapter of that section, you know, gets into kind of what you were talking about at the beginning of the interview, like kind of the urban spaces, or music and cities to set up your New York and European club chapters. So, can you talk a little bit, based on that third chapter, you know, what research has been done on music in cities or urban spaces?
So that's a big question, because cities have been subject of great interest to music studies for a long time. There are many different literatures on music in cities, and actually there's been also attempt to establish urban music studies as a discipline, which is something I in the book advise against. I think that this is probably not very meaningful. Although dialogue between the different perspectives, between different disciplines, I mean, can be developed further. I wouldn't sort of. I'm not arguing for subsuming all these different approaches into one discipline or into one sort of research field. So there's a lot of writing about music in cities. Maybe I can start by saying that this chapter is about, so you're talking about chapter three, right? Yeah. Okay. I think the point of that chapter is to show, you know, to some extent how diverse and fragmented, I mean, thinking, I mean, there's a long history of thinking about music in cities, and I wanted to show that, also look beyond popular music. This is one of the general aims of the book is, okay, it's mainly about popular music, but it's not confined to the idea of popular music studies. So there are also discussions in the book of other forms of music, of other musical cultures. I also wanted chapter 3 to create something of a history of music in cities throughout modernity in modern societies, from the beginnings of public concert life in the 18th century, which is really where which is really the birth of the consumer society, and at the same time of civic society, of secular musical culture. So that's also one of the aims of that chapter. I think the chapter serves to motivate this, the institutional approach, attention to micro level sociology, because this is something that hasn't been done very much.
Right. And I think that whole discussion in that chapter sets up, you know, kind of your more contemporary discussions, you know, in the New York area and different cities in Europe. And, you know, that structure that you get to later in the festival section, I think works well too. So I think you've done a good job of kind of bridging, you know, historical context with kind of like more recent manifestations, you know, of those themes that you're teasing out in those introductory chapters. And then going on to kind of more of the case study chapters, you know, chapters 4 and 5, you know, you get into clubs in New York, Amsterdam, Brussels, and Copenhagen. So what are some of the takeaways about performance institutions from those discussions?
Good question. I think the main... I mean, there are really two objectives throughout the book. One is to understand, you know, how institutions work. And how they can provide a more systematic understanding of how music fields sort of evolve. The other is to evaluate or to criticize, to think critically about this evolution. And in both New York and in the other cities, the main evolution is what I call the commercial institutionalization, and specifically the corporate institutionalization. The clubs have become that the general model of the club it's become a platform for a constant industry. I mean, so that, you know, also existed in the 60s and 70s, but it has now become more dominant. And there are types of clubs that have become rare, like the smaller experimental sort of clubs, owned by one person, you know, renting a space, DIY clubs. These things have become rare in the gentrified city. And then, you know, the argument is that this is not, I don't want to demonize the corporations or commercial club companies. I want to see them as organizations that are exploiting conditions created, by complex forces. So, When real estate prices go up and there are complex demographic changes in the city, the markets for concerts change and many aspects of cultural life change. I don't want to create this sort of simplistic, you know, negative image of the music and concert industry, but there are some really disturbing aspects of the development, I think, that says something about what we are losing in cultural life in cities, not just in music, because I think music illustrates this. I think that the transformation into a condition of life in which things are structured. I mean, many aspects of life are structured by professional work, by by commercial organizations. This is a more general picture of this more general condition. It's not only specific to music, but music shows it. Also, it shows that I think what is sort of unique to music, or what music it can tell us about the broader picture, is how restrained urban culture life has become. There's one passage in the book where I reflect on this sort of restrained and controlled, emotionally controlled, sort of very structured experience of music at the Bowery Ballroom or in some of the clubs in New York. That it's much more sort of, you know, it's much more structured compared to club experiences in earlier decades, which was more, it was more hedonistic, and there's no reason to have any sort of nostalgic or simple nostalgic sort of, you know, emotion about that. But certainly it shows that the condition of urban life, the cultural condition of urban life, has become more, maybe confined or sort of controlled, and it's more sort of defined by commercial and professional interests. So in some sense, although one of the reasons you know people go to concerts in the city is to experience some kind of emotional depth and freedom, they actually experience less emotional depth and freedom than people were able to sort of in past decades. And I think that's something to me is a bit troubling, and I think it also related to political culture and to concerns about climate change and I think other things. So it opens up broader perspectives, I think.
Yeah, and how do you see, I guess, those spaces changing in the current climate?
Oh yeah. So with the COVID-19,
yes,
I think it's a big. I think it's a collapse. Although it's not been described as a collapse in the media, I think that if it's not possible to organize concerts and festivals sort of professionally within the next year, I think it would be a major sort of collapse of the entire industry. But the vaccine could come in a few months, and then festivals could begin. You know, there could be festivals again the next summer. The festivals would certainly not be the same, but the demand for concerts and festivals will be great when they start again. So if the vaccine comes, or there's a cure, I think we're going to see things getting back to normal pretty quickly. If not, it will be a major crisis, and then so not just a crisis, but a collapse, and then it will take longer time before the industry is back. But I think it's going to come back to normal. I mean, within a few years.
Yeah, it'll be interesting to see how things unfold, and I know folks that are kind of trying to plan those types of events right now are grappling with a lot of unsure factors.
The uncertainty is so great that, I mean, although there are 20 teams or more, you know, working on a vaccine, we don't know how the virus is going to transform it is very uncertain.
Yeah, for sure.
But that would be good. I mean, it can be a good size to, I mean, from a cultural perspective, from a commercial perspective, I mean, from the business perspective, it's a disaster, no doubt. But from a cultural and social perspective, it might not be such a disaster, because the industry is not, you know, its goal is not to to create community or to grow and make music or culture more diverse. It's the main objective is to make profit, and that is sometimes forgotten. I think there's it's sometimes conflated that the industry is as if it's necessary for people to experience community and to enjoy themselves. And that is, I think that is not the case. It is to some extent doing that, but there are many other ways of experiencing community and experiencing music together. It doesn't have to be organized by an industry.
Right. And I think you kind of get at that in your conclusion. For instance, like you argue for alternatives to these narratives of commercial growth and consumer satisfaction. Like you call for more than that, it seems like.
Mm-hmm. Yes. Yeah. Yeah. That's true. I'm inspired by Martha Nussbaum's thinking, which is something she developed, with Amartya Sen, this idea of human growth. Which is distinct from it's something that they it's an idea that they developed something that they developed in their experience of researching and serving as consultants for world organizations in developing countries became skeptical or critical of thinking about growth in narrow economic terms, and especially of thinking about sort of the national economy, and saying that growth is also important to think of. I mean, there are some countries are very rich. For instance, South Africa under apartheid, it was a rich country sort of statistically. In general, it had a GNP, or what's it called? It was high. So there was a lot of capital in the country, but it was not evenly distributed, and it was a racist regime. That's one example. So this idea of human growth, it's something that they've been working on for a long time, and that sort of inspires me. I think that's something to think about, and something that the industry is not doing for us and can't
right.
do.
Yeah.
Because I really think it cannot do it, but it, to some extent, now it's appealing to in some countries to governments. I don't know. I don't want to be too specific, because it's also something I haven't researched, but my sense is that the industry is somehow appealing to this idea that if there is no industry, there's a valuable part of people's lives that will disappear, and that is true. But it can also, but that part, cultural life can also exist in less industrialized forms.
Right. So we've been talking a lot about kind of like more recent and kind of contemporary like aspects of these industries, but let's kind of take a step back, right, and look mm-hmm. at the history, for instance, of the music festival institution that you talked about in chapter 6. Can you talk about that kind of discussion you have there?
Yeah. This is one of the most fascinating, it was one of the most fascinating parts of the book for me during the writing. It was something I discovered, first. Just to be honest, I looked further back in history because I was somewhat, I felt that the field of thinking left to us and to me, including me, by the dominant ideas of festivals today, the field of thinking was too narrow. And so I began sort of thinking, okay, how can we understand this? How did this situation come into place? How did we end up in this place where, Lollapalooza and Coachella are sort of the dominant sort of image of what a festival is? And then I looked into the literature, and there's been this important work done by George McKay and others, tracing the history of the popular music festival. But it was then that I decided to look further back in history and say, I know that the books that I mentioned earlier examples, and we all heard the examples of the Wagner Festival in Bayreuth and the Mozart Festival in Salzburg. So at least the famous examples. I thought to myself, if this is an institution, if this is a sort of a phenomenon that has existed before, it must be possible to develop a more structured, a more clear analysis of their evolution and their history. So then I started reading about, the history of festivals and fest, cultural festivity, other types of festival events. And this opened up this perspective of this interpretation of the festival as a specific form of festivity. There are these examples of festivity that are less structured, that are more spontaneous. One of my sort of core examples is the festivity during the French Revolution that was constantly transforming, and took many forms. It never became a festival, although that the term festival has been used later. So these spontaneous and improvised forms of festivity, and then when it becomes a festival, this has happened in some situations, in some traditions, that it becomes regularized. It becomes so a festival. It happens at the same time every year. It has the same duration. There's a certain fixed program or order. So really, the main argument there is that the music festival, it evolved from annual celebrations in the church and into the secular music festival in the 18th century, and was there are many aspects of this, but one of them was that it was really associated with this idea of civic life and of forms of experiencing togetherness and publicness through singing. So that is sort of the this idea that through singing, these music festivals, these song festivals, if you will, were a central site for the experience of what it meant to be a modern secular being, citizen. And I think that is, to me, very fascinating. And I think that's something that we have partially lost. But then we have gained something else. The festival traditions today, the popular music festival traditions today, and also the classical and art music festivals, they're more professional, and there's a greater circulation of international stars. They're adapted to the needs of modern consumers. So it can all be explained and understood. But I think it's fascinating to see that the music festivals, that they had such a central role in this experience of a major transition in history. From the aristocratic society and the feudal society to the secular to secular democracies and capitalism.
Yeah. And you set up all that, like you were starting to get at, with kind of the contemporary manifestations of all those things leading up. You talk about factors like globalization, like you started to talk about like the corporate aspects and definitely the role of media, all this, in the next three chapters, 7 through 9. Can you talk about kind of these transformations of the festival institution in recent memory?
Yeah. This is I think the I think the general transformation is how the festival institution was adopted into Anglophone pop culture. Before the Second World War, it had a history in different cultural traditions, but with the evolution of various pop music cultures and jazz in the first half of the 20th century, and a new also with movies, so in general with this sort of with the new media culture that was mainly based in the United States and but also in England, and then spread to continental Europe. Festivals, sort of the festival institution became a platform for that media culture gradually. And then in recent decades, it's mostly a history of corporatization. And then how the festival is still serving, still sort of an institution of music and it's presenting new forms of music. But it's also an institution that serves the interests of these capitalist institutions and the advertising industry and other things. So the outlook and character, this is how I describe it. The outlook and character of festivals have transformed. This is also how we can understand, the evolution into a festival design of, multiple stages and large shopping areas, concessions, there's so much consumption at festivals now. If you look at the early pop music festivals, there was really one stage, a Greek plenum. We are all in the same area. We're all at the same stage. And, by programming, music, there's a constant stream of concerts and many stages, or several stages. These festivals can attract larger audiences but they also offer more entertainment. So it's not only, I don't mean to sound, to sound negative, but it is also a product of a commercial exploitation.
Right. It's really fascinating to see how much they have boomed, I guess.
Absolutely. And I think that's the books, again, speaking of the title, Everyone Loves Live Music. The industry, the concert industry certainly loves live music. And the book's argument is that the industry, live music is not, it's not just it's an object of pure love. It's also an object of commercial exploitation. That the industry has played a major role in transforming it into what it is today.
Yeah. Well, thank you for explaining kind of your ideas with the book, and I hope folks will be able to pick it up soon and check all of your excellent theorizing of all that and out. And so I'll conclude this interview with a question about what you've been reading, since this is a podcast for readers after all. So what books did you find most helpful with writing Everyone Loves Live Music?
I think the list of cited works is astronomic. 50 pages or so, but, I guess the way I want to respond to this, I would prefer to respond to this question is saying that I really, along the way, had many, many meaningful and encounters with sort of virtual encounters with authors in the past, both contemporary authors, but also way back, far back in history. And we have these, I think authors have these, have these virtual conversations, like you're reading something by, something by, um, by Shakespeare, or which I also did during the writing of this book, but I didn't cite him, or by a scholar from the 18th century or something. And you have these really meaningful experiences that is transforming how you think and opening up new doors and expanding your sort of your thinking. But these are somewhat, you know, these are experiences that they're extremely valuable, and it's really a part of what I think makes it so gratifying to be an author. But it's hard to mention any. I mean, with a work such as this, it's hard to mention one specific author or book.
I understand. I'm a bibliophile.
Yeah. But there are certainly books that you know, I read very carefully and that surprised me, and so that's another thing. I mean, with this book, I took a lot more time to read carefully than I've done, you know, many times in the past. So there are books that I read extremely carefully and said, okay, this is, I don't want to gloss over something. This is too important. I think all too often I think authors, including myself, have a tendency to skim something and then write about it in 15 minutes and then move on because we think it's just, you know, just a small step on the way. But, to build something and to create new understandings and to contribute something of quality, I think it's important to read and think very carefully. Rather, you know, cite fewer books. I mean, cite fewer books and articles, but read them more carefully.
Right, that makes a lot of sense. I think sometimes we just get in a big hurry and get, you know, compressed for time. And
well, the conditions today in academia are so that everyone has to publish frequently and they're rewarded for quantity. So there's this big, huge pressure to publish often. And as soon as it can be accepted by a journal or a publisher, the administration doesn't care because, in some countries, they're basically just counting points.
Right. And that shapes the reading process and all that.
Absolutely.
Yeah,
there are reasons why it has evolved into this. I think with this book, I just wanted to do something else. So I felt along a lot of the time that I was a little bit outside of history.
Yeah, I'm sure. And let me ask you this too: do you have any other projects underway? Not that a book alone isn't enough, but you know.
Yeah, I have some ideas. I've been working on ideas about emotional life in times of climate change, and music is part of it, but it's not exclusive. It's not about music only. I'm also thinking about writing a new sociology of music, so a book that is a more systematic, you know, introduction maybe, but also exploration of music from the, throughout the history of sociology, because there have been so those are two projects that I'm thinking about, but it's I'm still exploring.
Oh yeah, and I think based on what you just said, I definitely see those resonances coming out of this book, you know, to as a springboard for those projects. Cool. Thank you so much, Dr. Fabian Holt, for joining us today on New Books and Celebration Studies.
Well, thank you very much, Emily. It was a pleasure talking to you.
Yeah, no problem. And listeners, thank you for joining us as well. As a recap, this is the end of an interview with Dr. Fabian Holt about his book, Everyone Loves Live Music, A Theory of Performance Institutions, published by the University of Chicago Press in 2020. This is Emily Allen, and I'll see you next time here on New Books and Celebration Studies, a special series from the New Books Network.